I'm going to shut up and get on with the rest of the programme. Tony Gosling is a brilliant journalist, presents the politics show for BCFM. It airs on Fridays. It is a must listen. I first came across Tony many years ago when I was making radio programmes in Spain, and he came on my shows to regale me with brilliant stories of his own time working at the BBC, but also to educate me and my listeners about the Bilderberg Group and much more besides. Great guy. It's always brilliant to have him on the programme. Tony Gosling, thanks for coming on again. How are you, Tone?
Hi, Richie. I'd just like to tell you that you have finally been invited to join the Bilderberg Group.
Have I? Oh, Tony, please. I'm going up in the world. Do you know, I would say yes in a heartbeat, Tony. I'd sell out in a heartbeat. I'd be their first thing. First guy. Somebody said that to me before, Richie, if they gave you money to shut up, would you take it? And I always say, yes, I would. Of course I wouldn't. But I always say, yes, I would.
Take the money and then not shut up.
And then not shut up. That's it. Take the money and pay for your endeavours and not shut up.
Exactly.
Great to have you back on, Tony. Here's a quick question out of left field before we talk about the Brazilian election. If you said to me, Richie, come down to Bristol tomorrow, Wednesday, because we're going to a fancy dress party, and I want you to dress up. And if I decided to dress up as Phil Lynott, the legendary bass player from Thin Lizzy, I'm frontman, of course, great guy. And if I was to put the leather jacket on, Tony, and the bass, and the 70s gear, and the platform shoes, and all of that, if I was to use a bit of makeup to darken my countenance, would that be racist, Tony? And it's not a trick question. I don't know the right answer to this. We're talking about it today in the first hour. Blackface, is it racist or is it people getting hysterical about nothing, really?
Well, first of all, I'd say tomorrow is Tuesday, not Wednesday.
Yeah, of course it is. That's right.
But it depends. I guess it depends how it's done. You know, the black and white minstrels, the whole sort of gollywog thing, Robertson's jam, you know, this whole characterizing of Afro-Caribbeans as this kind of strange, curly-haired, that I think is racist. I think you've got to be, there is definitely a way of doing that, which is, you know, so it's just a sort of way of, I suppose, taking the mickey out of someone because of they look different. Now, you know, I think that's totally wrong. But having said that, I've seen the picture you'd spoken about of the guy on the tube.
Yeah, young guy.
And I retweeted it. I retweeted one word here, and that's provocation. I see lots of this, and another thing I would say is rather similar is this whole Pussy Riot thing, is where you go into a church and you do something that you shouldn't do, just to get a reaction. Now there seems to be quite a lot of this around, and I don't think it's really quite the same as just genuine freedom of expression. I think if someone, it almost depends on, it's a little bit like if you tell a joke about somebody, sometimes you can do it in a mean and cruel way, and other times you can do it in a kind way. In fact, even by satirizing some rich and powerful person, you can do that in a demeaning and really disgusting way, or you can do it in a genuinely humorous way. Like, for example, a similar thing is where you're doing some sort of comedy turn and you're swearing a lot, and there's, you know, elderly people and children around, and you don't necessarily have to be swearing to make that joke. So I think it's just a provocation. It's a way of getting a publicity and attention to something. Certainly, it's not the sort of thing I would, as an editor, report. I wouldn't say it was worthy of being reported, because that, I think, is the original object of an act like this. Someone doing something like this is to get attention for themselves, and the press seems to just run along on their coattails, where actually there's a fantastic amount, as you and I know, that they will not talk about.
Yeah, of course, much more important things. You're absolutely right, Tony. Listen, you might be right about the provocation aspect of it, but if he's not being provocative, there are so many issues here. Issue number one is, if he's being provocative, well, he's a bit of an arse. If he loves Pulp Fiction and he loves the character of Jules, pretty cool character, he's got some great lines in the film, and he's just doing it, he's not really racist then. I'll tell you, there's another issue just before we talk about Brazil and obviously austerity here, and we're going to talk about universal credit, very important, as you said, much more important issues. There's a privacy issue as well, Tony. We have people these days, when they see something they don't like, try to basically This young woman, this young model, maybe she was maybe she is genuinely offended by the guy. But is it the right thing to do to film people and put them on social media without their consent? I mean, the guy's in the national newspapers now. I can't imagine that's what, you know, what he wanted, you know, for his face to be out there and to be accused of racism. Are there privacy issues here? Seems that a lot of people are doing this now, filming something they don't like. Go on.
Listen, you're in public. There is no privacy issue. If you're out there in public, anyone has got a right to take a photograph of you. I mean, London Underground might have an issue with it, as it's their property. But if you're in public and you're displaying yourself in front of the public and someone takes a photograph of you, well, fair play to anybody. In fact, I would even say that if you're in a public space and somebody is in their own home but have got the windows wide open and are sort of facing out towards you, if you take a photograph into their house, then that's also something that you can see from the public space, and therefore that's also not an invasion of privacy if you take a photograph and then
publishing and then without their consent. Tony, we're talking about publishing without somebody's consent. This guy is out for a few drinks and a fancy dress party.
You don't need anybody's consent to publish a picture which is taken in public at all. No way. That's a really draconian type of a system that would start to say, well, this photographer has taken a picture of somebody and in public, and that then in some way they're not allowed to publish it. I mean, that you're starting to go down the road of an authoritarian state. That's the sort of thing you might see a law to protect, that sort of privacy. It's not privacy because you're in public, number one. But number two, photographers and journalists need to be able to do their job. You'll find most often photographers will be poking their nose into the grounds or the you know, from the street into the houses of the rich and powerful. We need to be able to continue for them to do that.
You can't see there's a big difference. I think there's a big I'm delighted we finally found something to disagree on, you and me. I think there's a huge difference between politicians, between people, public figures, people that are in the public eye and of the public interest, being chased when they deserve to be chased because they have to be exposed for one reason or another. And a guy who's out on the town and a woman starts videoing him, accuses him of racism, and then puts that on YouTube or Instagram without getting his consent. Tony, I can't phone you up tomorrow and record that conversation without getting your consent, Tony. I can't do that.
That's not in public. You know, if we are having a conversation on the tube and we're shouting and it's easy for people to hear it and someone records it, now hang on, now that actually, you're now starting to talk about potentially that might be actionable. But the idea taking a photograph of somebody in public and putting it online, it's a no-brainer. I do it all the time. And in fact, if I even see someone who's in a situation which is quite comical, I can remember taking a photograph of some guy who was stood at a till, but he was stood at a very strange angle. You know, he was kind of
right.
It was
right.
Like he was leaning on the till with his chest, and he was typing away or something on the, you know, on the till. It was in a shop, and I just thought it was a hilarious picture, and I took a picture of it. Now, it might be a little bit cruel to him, but hang on a minute. This is a free country. You take a photograph, you can publish it, for God's sake.
Okay, final word on this, because I think this is very interesting. This is an interesting segue. But won't it ultimately lead to, and again, we're not talking about pictures anymore. We're talking about videos. Won't this ultimately lead to, and this is a generation, of course, this is the millennial generation, or people born just before that, who think it's okay to confront or to, you know, take umbrage with something they don't like and video it and put it online in order so that that person can be chased and harassed and almost hunted. So I would argue what that will lead to, it will lead to, Tony, the imposition of self-censorship. Eventually people will be just terrified to open their mouths, whether they're in public or wherever. That's what I'm trying to get at. It's not a good thing, right?
What it might do is it might actually encourage people to put even more outrageous outfits on in order to get some attention and publicity.
Maybe. Look, I'll tell you what, we'll call it a draw. even though I'm pretty sure my listeners will probably be more inclined to support your argument. I'm sure they will be. Tony Gosling is our guest, folks. Terrific journalist. There aren't too many of them around. If you haven't checked out The Politics Show on BCFM, check it out. Tony, what about this Brazilian president who has been dubbed the Trump of the tropics. This right-wing politician, Jair Bolsonaro, who's allegedly at one time told a woman, a fellow lawmaker, that she was too ugly to rape. He supported the previous militant administration there. Everybody's worried about it. And columnists in the UK today are saying that this lurch to the right all over the world is something to truly fear. What do you think?
Well, first of all, he supported the previous dictatorships in Brazil, which is horrifying. I mean, this is a massive country, of course. By the way, if you go back to the 1950s, you'll find former Nazi war criminals running the Brazilian secret police. So these are the guys he was supporting. So that's what we're looking at here, really, is not a neo-Nazi, but a Nazi, someone who is prepared to employ Nazis in order to torture political dissidents in his country. This is the kind of guy he is. Now, the only reason he's there, and even in with a chance, is because the United States is spending billions on controlling various parts of the world, well, almost all parts of the world, including Britain, and that money goes on influencing elections. What's happened in Brazil over the last few years? First of all, we had Lula, who's a very popular left-wing president, trying his best to try and get a bit of social justice. Now, this is simply by, yes, it means taxing the super rich. And what it means is providing things like social services, schools, education, some decent, a bit of healthcare, fixing up the roads. That kind of thing. Lula was really popular. And then he was judicially... I mean, what we're talking about really over there is the judicial coup. Now, what you do is you just fix up a bunch of judges who will do what you want, easily bribable or, for whatever reason, maybe blackmailable into coming up with particular judicial decisions. And then you start to attack the popular leaders. And that's what they've done, exactly what they've done with Lula. He was jailed. And also Dilma Rousseff, who's the last elected president in Brazil. I noticed, by the way, and this is just me trawling through the old spider webs at the back of my brain somewhere, the last presidential election, whatever it was, 4 or 5 years ago, one of the main candidates, who was a socialist, died in a plane crash. You know, this is what goes on in Brazil. And so Dilma Rousseff, who was the last elected president over there, also from the left-wing party, who was seen very much as the successor to Lula, she was bounced out by the courts halfway through her presidency and told, oh, well, you're totally corrupt, blah, blah. Well, she wasn't corrupt. This is just the courts being misused in order to control who can and can't be president. And so this is why we are where we are. There's been an enormous amount of interference at the very apex. I mean, you know, the top of the pyramid of power in Brazil for the last probably 7, 8, 9, 10 years, really a lot, you know. So they've been the Americans mainly through their organization Southcom, who take a great deal of interest in who runs all the South American countries. This is called Southern Command, which basically runs South America. At least it's own, I wouldn't say necessarily, maybe that's exaggerating a little. So you know that what they do is they massively influence elections. And my colleague Martin Summers on the radio, I mean, he'd looked into this more than me, some of the military aspects of this. Apparently the Brazilian army is now massing on the Venezuelan border, potentially going to invade Venezuela, really effectively just as a kind of puppet for the United States. And that's who this guy is. He's not a populist leader. He's not actually even that popular. He's been put into power really by the media and also by the total erosion of the morale of the left by destroying all of their popular presidents over the last 10, 15 years. So that's really, I think, what's going on in Brazil. And it's a great pity because it's a very important country, particularly you know, as one of the BRICS nations, so-called independent, trying to forge an independent way away from the IMF, you know, who are basically the financial dictators of the planet. So it's not going to, it's not looking at all good for Brazilians, but it's really the finger of blame must be pointed at the Pentagon, at their unified command structure and the interference that they are doing constantly all over the world, but particularly in this case through Southcom, which is based in Miami. And we hear nothing about Southcom, even though it's one of the most powerful forces in the world, certainly the most powerful force in South America, for interfering in national politics.
We're a long way from the days of Hugo Chavez travelling around the continent, meeting the leaders of other countries and winning support for a unity on that continent, you know, a unity against the imperialist policies of the United States. It's not that long ago, Tony, but it feels like eons ago, doesn't it?
It does. And of course, there's a lot of evidence that he was poisoned to death. And that seems pretty clear. There were other poisonings of South American leaders. I think the Americans have decided that they're going to dominate the planet by hook or by crook. And I'm not talking about the American people. I'm talking about the deep state in the United States. Really, they took on the mantle of the Nazis after the Second World War, I suppose, for a few decades quietly. Then Kennedy was assassinated. And now we've got the War on Terror, which is their sort of, you know, wonderful brainchild, although the Brits, of course, were part of that too. That's, I think, what we're having to deal with now is they have become the rogue state that Nazi Germany was in the late 1930s and early 1940s, invading wherever they feel like, interfering in foreign governments, assassinating leaders. Now, the Israelis are guilty of this too. I mean, there's this amazing book, Rise Up and Kill First, which is by Ronan Bergman, which is talks about 2,700 assassinations of political leaders, religious leaders, etc., that the Israelis have been, the Secret Service, Israeli Secret Service has been doing over the last 30 years or so. And so this is now how the world is working, I think. We've really got to wait. If we haven't woken up to it already, we've got to wake up to it, is that there is a rogue state system out there based really, I think, around Israel, US and UK. But the real muscle, it comes from the United States, the financial muscle, the military muscle and the projection of power into other parts of the world. The Yanks are mainly behind this. And I'm afraid anybody like Hugo Chavez that is going to come along, in this present era, I think the Americans are so far ahead on this that they will try and bounce them out by whatever means, get them locked up, get them assassinated, have a plane crash or whatever, before someone like that ever gets close to power anymore. And the thing is, I mean, I visited South America a few decades ago, spent, a few months there, and I found that the people, ordinary people right across the continent, in all the countries I visited about 5 or 6 countries, are very much aware of the malign influence of the US. And I'm sure they are right now looking at Brazil and saying, well, this is not what Brazil wants, is it? It's what the Pentagon wants.
Well, the schoolyard bully was always a big lumpy fool, and he generally had a smaller guy with him manipulating him. And that's what Israel is. I mean, the Zionist control of the United States is pretty much total. So you're right to talk about the military might and the finance and the muscle of the US. But in terms of strategy, all roads certainly lead to Israel. And this is not anti-Semitism or Israelophobia. It's just a fact, isn't it? I mean, the country's under the complete control of the Zionist lobby and the Zionist government of Israel.
But there is a strong British-Israel project in Britain as well as in the US. I mean, but I think they have what they've done, the Zionists and Freemasons as well. Many of the Freemasons are very much into this whole sort of Zionist idea. And if you go in to look at the Masonic rituals, you'll find a lot of based around the temple in Jerusalem, this kind of thing. So there's this sort of religious fanaticism, fundamentalism around Freemasonry that is also very much mirrors the sorts of ideals that drive a lot of the fundamentalist Israelis. And it's actually quite, many Jewish people I know and I've spoken to are really getting concerned about the direction since the mid-1990s that the Israeli state has taken.
Yeah.
A racist direction, an extremist direction, and also almost relishing the prospect of war, with the Arab world. Now, just a minute, guys, you have almost all of you are Europeans who've migrated down to the Levant, to the around sort of Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, wherever, into the Israeli state. And you're now saying that you want a war with the indigenous people down there. Now, there's lots and lots of Jews that can see just how dangerous that could be. And, you know, so it's no way anti-Semitic to be looking at that project as potentially explosive and potentially even seeding a third world war. It's no exaggeration to say that if the Israelis and the Iranians start to kick off against one another, as the Israelis actually have been threatening recently. I noticed, Netanyahu, was it a couple of months ago now, stood outside Dimona, the nuclear place, saying, "Oh, you know, we could easily attack Iran." What is he playing at? Then that would bring in the Americans almost certainly, because you know you're going to have the Russians fighting with Israelis. Americans would come along, and then quite easily the Chinese could be dragged into that part of the world. They're playing with fire, Richie, and we need to be, I think, putting the finger on the Israelis, 100% the Israeli state. Either you behave, or we're going to kick you out of the United Nations, and we're going to make you a pariah state. Behave, you know? And there's no excuse to be racist just because you're Jewish. No chance.
Tony Gosling is our guest, thisweek.org.uk. Check him out, bilderberg.org. Great man. Top journalist is Tony. Lots to get through. It's 28 and a half minutes to the top of the hour. And there's been a mass of tweets on this. Go to twitter.com, Richie Allen Show, all one word. Press enter and you'll see what people are tweeting me. Loads to talk about. There are those who listen to this programme and they say, guys like me, we spend an inordinate amount of time focusing on Israel and we're obsessed with Israel, and that it can lead to, I don't agree with this, of course, but it has been said, and it's been said a lot today in the UK press and the UK media, that blaming Israel and seeing Israel as being responsible for most of the world's wrongs and injustices can lead occasionally to people getting terrible ideas into their heads and doing things like what happened in Pittsburgh on Saturday, where 11 people were murdered at a synagogue. People were there to celebrate the birth of a new baby into the community. 11 people were killed. And right across the board, people are saying, well, this is evidence that anti-Semitism is a real thing, and this is what it leads to. What have you made of what happened on Saturday, Tony, and the reporting of it since then?
Well, certainly, I mean, the main thing for me is that this guy appears to be a Native American descent, which is bizarre to think that he is, wading in this direction as anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic. I don't quite understand why it might be, but there is obviously an attempt, I think, anyway, to focus on faith and religion as the heart of the problem. And actually, the media is guilty of this. For example, just today we've had the International Secular Society's report come out across the world saying that various countries are okay for people who don't believe in God, and other places are not okay. Like obviously Saudi Arabia, you've got to believe in God in Saudi Arabia, and I'd totally be behind them on saying that people should have freedom of conscience. I mean, that's just a basic human right, yeah, which doesn't really exist in Saudi Arabia. But the other side of that is that, you know, there are people who believe that the faiths themselves are the heart of the problem. And I just think that that's a really dangerous idea. And actually what happened, of course, I mean, you know, you're Irish yourself. There was a lot of focus on, this is the problem of faith going on in the Troubles, in the Northern Ireland Troubles. It's the Protestants are trying to kill the Catholics. Why can't they just give up any idea of God and everything would be fine? Actually, of course, it was much deeper than that. And it was a struggle between two entire cultures. Many of the people, of course, involved in the actual terrorism had no belief in God. They were part of either a Republican community or a Loyalist community. And those people who were involved in the terrorism may have possibly have been going to church, but the chances are they probably weren't. And yet there was always this focus on the Catholics and the Protestants, the Catholics and Protestants. And I think that the press really needs to get its act together to get deeper into these big global conflicts, and particularly with the Israelis. This is not anything to do with ordinary people that go to a synagogue. This is the Israeli state. And when someone like Netanyahu puts on his, you know, oh, we're just doing this for God thing, I think we just need to call him out. It's the same, really, as Theresa May and Prince Charles talking about God, particularly Theresa May, when she says, oh, you know, I use God to guide me and the Bible to guide me and my faith to guide me. Rubbish. Absolute nonsense. All she's doing is she's trying to whitewash herself and she's faking it. You know, basically she's saying, oh, look, here's something good over here and I'm going to, you know, rub a little bit of goodness on me and everyone will think I'm great. Well, sorry, mate. It just doesn't wash with me. And if the press don't actually call that out, then we're going to get more of these sorts of attacks, I would imagine. I mean, let's also look at some equivalent sort of thing that was going on. I remember looking really, really deeply into attacks on the Coptic Christians in Egypt when around the time of after the Arab Spring, not long after that. And it was quite clear that the government was doing these attacks on the, it was actually the Interior Ministry that was doing the attacks on the Coptic Christian churches and then trying to use it to say, oh, well, we've got this massive religious conflict problem going on. Actually, no, it was the Interior Ministry. That's the Home Office it would be equivalent of in Britain. So let's just make sure that, you know, we don't jump to conclusions about why this has happened. Obviously, it's an appalling thing to happen to people as they're worshipping on it early on a Saturday morning. And trying to do some proper analysis. But I can't see people like CNN and NBC and the rest of them doing that, I'm afraid.
No, it's cliche. It's rhetoric and cliche. Patricia tweets, this is too funny. She's in Switzerland, by the way. The Israelis are threatening Iran. What country are they looking to for that? Tweets Patricia. Oh, that's right, the good old USA. I would like to know how many Israelis have died in the wars, also known as invasions, so far in the Middle East. Patricia there, thanks for that. Keep the tweets coming in. Tony, homelessness is on the rise in this country. Anybody who lives near one of the major cities and who spends time in their town centres, in their cities, you can't help but notice that it's on the increase. I've lived in this city, it's my second time living here. We've been back here now over 4 years and we've seen it in Manchester city centre year on year on year. And Universal Credit, and some of our listeners, depending on where they are in the world, might not know what it is. It's a social welfare payment. It's a system where certain benefits that people would have got staggered maybe in the past over a monthly period have now been rolled into one. And it's led to all sorts of hardship for people. It was predicted it would do. It's caused all sorts of problems with people who are waiting longer than they were supposed to wait for their payment. And it has resulted in people ending up on the streets and more people going to food banks. Today, as Tony Gosling will know better than me, is the day when the Chancellor of the Exchequer announces his budget for the next year, the fiscal year. Basically, it's the government's outlining its spending plans, what it needs to spend over the next 12 months, but also how it will do that, namely what taxes it will raise or lower and how much borrowing it will do. One of the big lines that's come out of this is this notion that austerity is over. The Prime Minister Theresa May said this at the Conservative Party conference in Birmingham a couple of weeks back. And Philip Hammond said this today, austerity is over, Tony. Is it?
Of course it's not.
No.
What they're doing is they're just maybe reining back a little tiny bit. But look, all I can say is that the system at the moment is every week punishing people, more and more people. I mean, you'd have to just completely abolish universal credit and have some kind of universal basic income, which you don't have to apply for. You just get automatically in order to do anything to stop it. Anybody that's on benefits will know this. And we call them benefits. Actually, what they really are is social security. For those people who've paid their national insurance, this should be a guaranteed payment that's made to them based on the fact that they haven't managed to get any work. And if you can't get work, then you should be guaranteed this payment. And obviously, one of the reasons for many people that they aren't in work is because of the incredible low wages when they do get work. This has been driven down in all sorts of ways by the government, by big business. And what have they done today? I noticed he's given tax breaks, Philip Hammond, for businesses, business rate breaks for people on the high street, which sounds great, doesn't it? But why not just give money to the poor? so they can spend money on the high street, then you don't need to give any business tax breaks to the companies. You know, so what they're trying to do is shrink the state. They want no state. They want survival of the fittest. They want the law of the jungle and money to be the only really valuable thing or thing that people use to decide anything in society. And they, as they shrink the state, of course, they're starting to shrink the possibility of having decent education. They've tried to privatize that through the academy schools, some of which are collapsing, you know, many of which are really poor quality. I mean, you can do, basically they're run like a company would be, with bully bosses as headmasters and headmistresses, as opposed to the old state sector. So, I mean, austerity, no, it's not gone. And it's really a tool just to beat poor people who don't vote Tory. And, of course, why would the Tories be even vaguely interested in giving any money to people who don't vote for them?
The Labour Party might very well form the next government. And you and I have been mates, and we've been speaking on programmes like this now since 2009, believe it or not, 2010. And problem with the Labour Party is, regardless of whether Jeremy Corbyn is real, whether he's genuine or not, I suspect he's not, but I've been banging this drum forever and ever and ever. We'll never change our lives. We'll never change the paradigm by going to the ballot box and voting for any of these people. Why? Because of the creation of money. The ultimate conspiracy. Who controls the creation of money? What the Labour Party will do, in its wisdom, it will do some of what you suggested. It will try and give money to people who desperately need it to get them back on their feet and get them out spending money in the economy again. But one of the ways it will do that is by borrowing. And see, this is the never-ending death cult. The death cult money system. Fractional reserve banking, right? This is true, right? It's what Labour will do, right?
What happens if the government don't pay the money back? They can just stick two fingers up to the banks if they feel like it.
Yes, but Jeremy Corbyn's not going to do that, Tony.
If the banks are doing what they did in 2008 and pointing a gun to the head of the Prime Minister saying, look, sign here, you need to give us a load of government money, otherwise all our entire financial system is going to go down. If they do that sort of thing, then the government can just simply say to those banks, shrug its shoulders and say, well, sorry, all that money that you wanted back from us, forget it, mate. The government needs to get tough with the
But
city.
They won't, Tony. But they won't ever. Let me just put this to you. Tony Gosling is our guest. Folks, top man, great programme. If you haven't heard it before, thisweek.org.uk, the politics show for BCFM. It's a rare treat, that, weekly. Check it out. I mean that from the bottom of my heart. Listen, Jeremy Corbyn is never going to say this. I had Steve Keane on this programme a few times in the last couple of years. Find him very nice guy, very jovial guy. He's very interested in the policies and the ideas of John McDonnell. And I challenged Steve Keane about the creation of money and capital, fractional reserve banking and central banks and where money really comes from. And he was a bit, he was kind of a little bit reluctant to get involved, but eventually he got involved with me, and he said, Richie, you are right. It is ridiculous for Richie to borrow from the bank of Richie to pay for Richie's programme of Richie. It's ridiculous. Who do we owe the money to? He acknowledged this to be true. And I said, well, that's a system that ultimately benefits only one person. That is the less than 0.001% of humanity, the super elites, who ultimately, using that system, accrue the real wealth of the world by getting everybody into debt. Steve Keane admitted this. Now, this will never be discussed on Sky News or the BBC or even RT. Jeremy Corbyn, my friend, and I am going to shut up and let you have the floor for as long as you want, is never, no more than JFK did, no more than Roosevelt did, is ever going to take on the banking institutions of the world and tell them to get stuffed. That's my opinion. It ain't ever going to happen. Go ahead.
Well, if they were going to do it, Richie, they wouldn't be saying anything before the election, that's for sure. In fact, this is one of the things that they tried to do over in Greece, and they're trying to do it now in Italy, is to, you know, for the government, the elected government, to actually get a grip on the money system. And in Italy, they've been told, no, you're not going to do it. Yeah. So, but I mean, that you have to be very, very clever about the way you do it. So in other words, it's got to be a secret. So you're not going to go into an election campaign saying, blah, 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 we're going to do X, Y, and Z. You need to arrive in power and then do it. And I mean, that's I think, the sort of way that they would do it. They wouldn't necessarily make a big fuss about it before an election. I think they'd be foolish to do so. They would announce a plan B or plan C or whatever it is when the financial crisis hits. Now, quite whether John McDonnell, Steve Keen, other advisors of his have got the nous to do it and, you know, the balls to do it, that I'm not sure, but that's what they need to do. They certainly need to come to grips with the creation of money, the system of creation of money. You're absolutely right about that.
Can I just clarify something, Tone?
Doing it is you just have a reset. That is, in other words, you say, well, this debt is all unpayable. Let's just wipe the slate clean. That's another way to do it. The Jubilee, which is, you know, another way of saying it.
Can I get a quick clarification from you? Are you telling me that you think that it's possible that Corbyn and McDonnell might be looking to the near future, privately, secretly, a future where they would take control of the creation of money and the money supply away from how money is created now? And just in case our listeners don't know, this is how money is created now. The government says it needs money to pay for the NHS, to pay for the police, to pay for education. It issues government bonds and treasury bonds, which is a promissory note. And they sell those bonds to the Bank of England and to other stakeholders, pension funds and stuff, who basically give money to the government. But when they do, they create that money out of thin air. It doesn't exist. You actually think there's a possibility that Corbyn and McDonnell will say, right, that is over. No more borrowing from our own bank to pay for our own programs of government. We're going to take control of the money supply and issue debt-free currency.
And you know why I think they might do that?
Right.
It's because Mervyn King, the former, I mean, basically Mark Carney is one of the instigators, the present governor of the Bank of England, one of the instigators of the financial crisis when he was working at the Bank for International Settlements, which is the central banker's central bank in Basel, Switzerland. He was chairing the regulation committee that deregulated, that allowed the financial crisis to happen in 2008, which wasn't a crash. It was a massive bailout by the public of those private banks. But Mervyn King, he's a different character. He was the former Bank of England governor, and he has been constantly warning people. He's, you only hear the odd little squeak from him, but he's saying the same thing each time. He's saying, look, we haven't fixed the problem. We need to be ready for it. We haven't fixed the problem. So there are voices out there, powerful, influential voices, who are saying, listen, guys, when this next financial crisis happens, when we get the next 2008, we've got to have a plan ready to deal with it properly, because we didn't deal with it properly in 2008. Now, I'm not saying I've got any kind of great insight into John McDonnell, although I did interview him once and I found him actually a pretty smart guy, you know, and a decent, honest bloke, you know, sort of person you could have a pint with down the pub. And you know, I think he's also looking at doing root and branch reforms. Remember, he's 100% into nationalising stuff. He's a proper socialist. He thinks if there's a part of the national infrastructure that ain't working,
Tony. Tony, let me jump in there, because we've got to have a back and forth on this. This is really important.
Sure.
Tony Gosling is our guest. Love the man. His opinions are worth listening to, folks. Agree or disagree, it doesn't matter. This is important stuff. You see, I'll tell you why I don't believe any of this. First of all, they'd be dead long before now if they ever had any intentions of doing that, in my opinion. But secondly, Tone, if McDonnell and Corbyn are serious about the nationalisation programme that they've promised in the event they form the next government, and like yourself, my friend, because our opinions, we've known each other for years, we have the same outlook on life. We believe in justice. We believe in fairness. I think we believe in socialism deep down. I think that's who we are. And I go along with it 100%. Corbyn and McDonnell can't implement this nationalisation programme that I would love more than anything, because they want to basically keep the country in the European Union, and the European Union won't allow it.
Well,
we should see.
I mean, I don't think they do, actually. No, I mean, particularly Corbyn, I'm not so sure about McDonnell, isn't interested really so much in keeping Britain in the EU. There is a very strong strain in the Labour Party right now that understands the dangers of not leaving the EU. right? So that isn't, I'm not just talking about that it means that you don't have any power if you get elected to number 10 if you don't leave. I'm talking about the social consequences. That is to say, the rise of the far right, the rise, the potential rise of the Tommy Robinson faction.
Yeah.
If we don't leave. And there is a there are a lot of Labour people that understand this and are really concerned about it. And whatever they might feel about the Socialist International, which is actually what drives many of them, this dream of having some sort of international socialist system that many of them were brought up with in their sort of Marxist upbringing. That's one of the things that really drives them to Brussels. But they are really reacting, I think, against that, understanding that if we do not leave now we voted to leave, that this is just going to be like a red rag to a bull to the far right, and the far right are going to really start to take off, particularly since we've got this kind of mass poverty going on in Britain, with this hidden poverty where people are hardly have enough money to put food on the table, have to go to food banks and all that. This is where the far right thrives, and I think there's many Labour people that understand that. So I don't think it's all cut and dried. I mean, this is one of the things I've learned over the years, Richie, is that it is, the future is up for grabs, and it's not all sealed by the Bilderbergers and people like that. They like to think they've got, and they have got, a fantastic amount of influence. They've got a tremendous amount of wealth, but they can't buy people's souls, and they can't buy the future. All they can do is they can influence it. And if we're stupid enough, if we're badly informed enough, that what they want to happen will happen. But this is, it's a bit of a gambit and a game for them. I mean, even these wars, I think they see as games. We're going for a game here. And they're almost like they're playing a war game when they go down to, you know, Syria to try and do X, Y, and Z, to have a proxy army or whatever. So I think there's a real possibility that in 2022, whenever this election is, it probably will be that late, I think, actually. Not the Tories are not going to allow an early election. I very much doubt that. And if Corbyn is still around, and if he still manages, you know, and if he manages to win, we will see some really big changes, particularly bigger, because we will by then be outside the European Union.
You deserve the last word, and that was it, Tone. Thanks for that, mate.
Can I say one quick thing?
You can, please? Go
Which
ahead,
just
yeah.
About this Lion Air crash in Indonesia today, I looked at the...
Very new plane, Tony. Very new plane, is that right?
That's right, brand new aeroplane. I mean, we're not living in the 1950s with the Comet, you know, where these planes are experimental and they might fall out of the sky. No, we're not. This aircraft, it's almost impossible for it to crash like this. Any pilot will tell you that if there was some sort of basic problem, he would have been able to put the plane down and safely on the water, and people would have been able to get out on the chutes, etc. So what on earth is going on here? I noticed in an article in the Jakarta Post that they had an audit team from the foreign ministry, an environment ministry of the Indonesian government, and that the guy that runs the airline is actually, or he owns the airline, is actually an ambassador for the government, for goodness sake. So who knows what's going on here? It looks to me as if it might even be a way of getting rid of this audit team who were looking into the Indonesian government. But it certainly should not happen that a plane should crash like this. The pilot, any pilot would normally be able to put an aircraft down if they had some sort of serious failure in a reasonably safe fashion. Almost certainly, looking at this, so it's highly likely that this aircraft has been hacked and brought down deliberately. That's all I'd say.
That's really interesting, Tony. And a former guest on this programme, a very eccentric man, very eccentric, but I think a very brilliant man, Field McConnell, who's flown everything for the US Navy and flown every commercial jet. I'd be very interested to get his take on that. That's fascinating. I didn't consider that at all. I didn't know any of that. You've educated me.
I just looked into who's on board, and having one of the main Indonesian government audit teams on board. Well, that's very handy that those guys. I mean, let's not forget who was on board Pan Am Flight 102 at Lockerbie. There was a whole CIA investigation team. A government investigation team that had been looking into CIA drug dealing in the Middle East. I mean, I did articles on the MH17 crash, the Ukrainian Malaysian airliner, and also the MH370, the one that so-called disappeared, almost certainly was hacked and flown, or maybe using the military speaking to the pilot to persuade him to fly to Diego Garcia. So that plane didn't disappear. It was just, I think, flown to a US airbase, and there were some people on board the MH370 who had some kind of high-tech military thing that they were talking about they wanted to sell to the Chinese military. And I imagine that the Americans might take an interest in that and say, well, that plane is not going to get to its destination. So I think we have to look at these sorts of slightly unexplained, mysterious crashes, and look at the technology that's involved in being able to hack into and control these planes remotely, which is actually a pretty simple thing to do, rather worryingly.
It is indeed, mate. Cheers for coming back on, Tony. You know how much I love having you on, and I know you're very busy, so I appreciate it. The Politics Show, bcfmthisweek.org.uk. Follow Tony on Twitter as well. I hope you come back real soon, mate. Thanks again.
God bless. Thanks for having us on again, Richie. Cheers.
It's an honour, mate. Cheers. I mean that. Tony Gosling, top man, live from Bristol there. Thisweek.org.uk is where you'll find out more about the Politics Show. If you haven't heard it before, it's a top listen. It really is.